On quiet break of day. When the blues creep up on you and carry your mind away. While I lay in my bed and cannot go to sleep. While I lay in my bed and cannot go to sleep. While my heart's in trouble and my mind is thinking deep. My mind was running back to days of long ago. My mind was running back to days of long ago. Anyone I love, I don't see her in. Come to me yesterday, been with me all night long. I've been so worried, I didn't know what to do. I've been so worried, I didn't know what. I guess that's why I've had these midnight hours with you.
The Free University of the Airwaves continues here on Resonance 104.4 FM with Edward Simpson of the School of Oriental and African Studies. He talks about remembering natural disasters and memorials in India and Sri Lanka.
This lecture is about memorial practices that emerged after the 2001 earthquake in Gujarat, Western India, and along the eastern and southern coasts of Sri Lanka following the tsunami of 2004. The research on which this lecture is based was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council's Non-Governmental Public Action Programme and has been conducted jointly with Malati de Alwi from the International Centre for Ethnic Studies in Colombo, Sri Lanka. I have largely omitted references to published work, a brief list of relevant readings, as well as images of the memorials referred to in this lecture are available from the Resonance FM website. In both India and Sri Lanka, acts of memorialisation, that is to say, building memorials, have been inseparable from the broader process of rebuilding what was destroyed. In both locations, too, politics of all kinds and at all levels have influenced the design, location, and inauguration ceremonies of memorials. For more than a decade, Gujarat has been governed by a political party with a strong Hindu nationalist agenda. The party is known as the BJP. The BJP's version of popular Hindu nationalism is a political force which attempts to unite all Hindus, reviving apparently lost golden age of civilization. In Gujarat, the Hindu nationalists have done this largely by uniting around a demonization of the Muslim population, which forms around 18%. In Gujarat, therefore, memorials are primarily tied to the politics of religious nationalism, and to a lesser extent to the politics of regionalism. In contrast, in Sri Lanka, memorials are local manifestations of ethno-nationalisms and state power. Sri Lanka is divided by a long-running civil war between the southern Sinhala-speaking population and the breakaway Tamil population to the north, who are represented by the Tamil Tigers. There is also a significant population of Muslims on the east coast. It is these political divisions that run most clearly through the memorial practices evident in both locations. From the outset, I wish to draw attention to the fact that there is a clear distinction between memorials created by the people and by the state in both Gujarat and Sri Lanka. I want to ask, what is a memorial? What does it do? Who is it for? Common sense may provide ready answers to these questions. A memorial remembers an event. A memorial acts as a reminder and brings people together in remembering. A memorial is for those affected by an event and those people who are yet to come. You may already have a memorial in mind and may already have thought about how you relate to and experience the memorial as an object. In this lecture, I wish to challenge some of the common assumptions about the purpose of memorials, using theory and method from contemporary anthropology. Before I go any further, however, I want to ask you two questions, which I am not going to answer directly. But they are questions which might be a useful way of framing the material from South Asia. First, how do we distinguish memorials from other objects? Or, in other words, what is and what is not a memorial? What is it that makes a memorial and not something else? The second question I wish to ask is, how do we relate to memorials? Are these ways of acting and thinking in and around particular objects natural, or are they something we have learned? If, just suppose, the way we identify and behave around memorials is something learned, could it be, if we push the argument a little harder, that remembering itself is something learned, rather like learning to count or to distinguish between different colours? Is memory natural or cultural? We assume, of course, it is natural, but what if it's not? In both India and Sri Lanka, the starting points for many of the debates surrounding memorials, their authenticity and legitimacy, have been informed by patterns of social hierarchy, polity and so forth that long preceded both disasters. The reanimation of pre-existing social patterns has been accompanied by a grooming of the past for images and metaphors to accommodate and mediate expressions of mourning and loss. Both disasters are clearly also breaks with the past, at least in terms of personal memory, but also because of the renewed importance of the past more generally. There is, in a sense, now more past in the present than there was before. People think and talk about the past much more now than they used to. The structure and presentation of these nostalgic pasts, and the ways in which they are projected onto the landscape as memorials, has led to the increasing importance of regional identity in both countries. In Gujarat, this has led to the rise of a campaign for regional autonomy in the worst affected part of the state, and in Sri Lanka, this has meant the realignment of various regional administrative and political boundaries. Even a cursory comparison between memorials in Gujarat and Sri Lanka raises a variety of questions. Why are there more memorials in Sri Lanka than in Gujarat? Why do many memorials in Sri Lanka graphically depict the disaster, while those in Gujarat are nearly always abstract objects? Why are a greater percentage of memorials in Gujarat erected by state or semi-state organisations, whereas in Sri Lanka most have been erected by people's collectives? Why have state-sponsored memorials in Gujarat managed to remain more or less secular, perhaps contrary to what might have been expected, given the popular association of the state with bellicose Hindu nationalism, while what was initially a similar trend in Sri Lanka has now taken on distinct Buddhist overtones? Why are there no memorials to the Muslim dead in either Sri Lanka or Gujarat? I'm going to refrain from attempting to answer all of these questions, but my primary objective will be to explore particular ways in which memory has been politicised in both Gujarat and Sri Lanka, while simultaneously challenging two of the assumptions on which conventional answers to these initial questions might be based. The literature makes it very clear that memorials are social objects, products of particular times and places, and open to constant reinterpretation. In what follows, I take it for granted that memorials have histories, and that one man's memorial is perhaps a symbol of another's oppression, defeat, or loss. I do not wish to dwell further on this somewhat common sense assumption, other than to illustrate the malleable nature of memorials with an example which might be familiar to some listeners. The historian K.S. Inglis has described how the bronze statue, originally called the Homecoming, at the end of Station Road in Cambridge, was initially erected as a monument to victory after the First World War, but has gradually been transformed into a monument for the dead of the two wars. His instructive account shows how conflicts, both old and new, have clustered around the way the object is interpreted and venerated, to the point that the object itself is clearly quite at odds with the broader sentiment it is now popularly held to represent. The chirpy-looking soldier on top of the plinth was initially put there as a celebration of victory, but it's now regarded as a monument to the dead. Now I come to the two commonly held assumptions in the substantial literature on memorials that I wish to challenge in this lecture. The first assumption, and my challenge to it. The first assumption I wish to challenge is that memorials exist in order to remember an event. In this sense, I wish, as other writers have done, to expand the category of memory, to include more than straightforward recollection. I see memory as a form of politics, in which different domains of knowledge and experience are brought together in unpredictable ways. In other words, the composition and nature of memory in relation to memorials is anything but a foregone conclusion. Objects do not remember. Only people and societies do. Objects may suggest a record, and perhaps act as an aid for the work of memory. For sure, memorials are commonly tied to particular events. But what kinds of memory can memorials be actually said to represent, or, conversely, evoke? People who experience catastrophe, for example, may bring their own terrible and grotesque memories of particular moments and tragedies with them when they visit a memorial. They may also bring with them memories which are simply too terrible to articulate and will always remain hidden from view. These are clearly quite different memorial evocations to state discourses on natural disasters. The memorial, then, may be a public representation of the diverse and perhaps contradictory experiences of many individuals. Names, dates, particular words, and sometimes images become the focus of public attention, replacing the altogether less palatable smell of blood or the haunting image of the face of a dying child. The memorial flattens the extremes of individual memory, replacing it, and therefore, in a sense, denying it or pacifying it, with something altogether more palatable, if not to say anodyne. This is, perhaps, one of the fundamental functions of a memorial. The memorial becomes a device to think about an event. The memorial translates the unthinkable into the thinkable, and the event becomes accessible to others. Other configurations of objects and memory are also possible, because although memorials allow for individual memories, the device itself, however, reflects more the concerns of those who put it there and those that control the public activities that may surround it. Thus far, I have implicitly assumed memorials are erected by those who've been directly affected by the memorialized event. Those who put them there, however, we shall see, are often other people altogether. In both Gujarat and Sri Lanka, memorials often tended to be done for people affected by the disaster rather than by them. The second assumption and my challenge to it. There is also a tendency in the recent literature to see memorials as cultural indices. Different cultures produce different types of memorials. Some authors have also taken this further and argued that different kinds of events within particular cultures also tend to be marked by different types of memorials. The second assumption, then, common to the literature I wish to challenge, is the idea that memorials represent something fundamental about the culture of the memorializers. I do not, of course, totally discount the idea that there is a relationship between the memorial and the cultural compulsions of particular societies, for that would be perverse. However, I wish to dismantle the commonplace idea that the design, form, and location of a memorial, as well as the type of interaction between it and the memorializers, can simply be read as outward and tangible signs of underlying cultural meanings laid particularly bare by tragedy. It may well be that the squabbles and lobbying that gave birth to memorials are revealing of underlying social processes, but memorial devices do not simply represent such processes, any more than they simply engage memory. These days, at least, no anthropologist would give credit to the idea that if a people did not build memorials, they did not have culture. Conversely, then, why should memorials be seen as the pinnacle of culture, let alone meaningful units for cross-cultural comparison. There are two further things to be said on this matter. First, memorial practices, at least those I'm discussing, are largely borrowings from other times and other places, forms of cultural plagiarism, if you like, which remind us that culture, as memorial practices themselves, is not timeless or bounded. Secondly, it seems to me that scholarly schemes on memorials are often imbued with distinctly European notions of state and memory, and more significantly, erroneously rely on the idea that trauma and loss guarantee the authenticity of the cultural sentiment. To be clear, the literature seems to rely on the fact that because people are traumatized by what they have experienced, then what they do is particularly authentic and does not need to be qualified with the usual disclaimers social scientists usually apply to the objectiveness of their research. This seems to me to be particularly wide of the mark, if not to say wrong. By muddying the relationship between memorials and memory, and suggesting memorials are products of cultural compromise, borrowing, and perhaps even the globalization of a non-governmental culture, which seeks to promote particular ideas about memorials as a humanitarian aspect of post-disaster reconstruction, I wish to move away from the idea that memorials are the pinnacle of culture towards looking at the processes that produce such objects. The Gujarat earthquake. On the 26th of January 2001, an earthquake hit the district of Kutch in Gujarat, western India. Upwards of 13,000 people lost their lives, and around 900 villages were reduced to rubble. The disaster generally affected rich and poor, in both rural and urban areas, as tens of thousands of ordinary people lost their homes. The earthquake occurred on Republic Day, a national and nationalistic holiday. Kutch bore the brunt of the tremors and accounted for more than 90% of the fatalities in Gujarat. Around 1% of this sparsely populated and relatively inaccessible area lost their lives. The earthquake popularly became known as Shiva's Dance of Destruction. It was variously described as something like a distant flour mill, an atomic explosion. Some people believed the world was coming to an end. Others believed that war had broken out with Pakistan. It shook confidence in God and nature. Several theories as to why the earthquake had occurred surfaced quickly, with blame being placed at the feet of various wrongdoers. In some quarters, it emerged that the disaster was divine retribution for the wholesale betrayal of cultural traditions, in favour of the modern values of consumerism and immorality. Significantly, however, neither the relative intensity of the disaster, nor the accounts of blame and retribution that emerged in the aftermath, have had any lasting impact on the way in which memorials are being considered. Memorials have largely been discussed in terms of state nationalism, not blame. Some villages in Kutch were rebuilt by the governments of other Indian states, notably those of Maharashtra, Rajasthan, and Delhi. In these locations, a memorial was nearly always incorporated into the plan. In villages built by international development organizations, memorials, when they did appear, were largely afterthoughts. Other villages were reconstructed by private welfare and cultural organizations, often with nationalist agendas. One such village is Indraprastha, where a monument to the earthquake dead was built on top of a small hillock, which was named Tiger Hill. On a plaque set into the foundations of a pole for the national flag is a list in Hindi, not either of the local languages Gujarati or Kutchi, of the names of the villagers who perished. The hillock has been planted with sweet-smelling flowers, and when power and water permit, a fountain cascades down an artificial watercourse. This type of structure is quite alien to rural Gujarat, as are the associations the structure somewhat crudely evokes. The monument establishes a direct connection between the earthquake dead and the ideas and symbolism of sacrifice for the nation. The bloody and partially televised battle for the real Tiger Hill, which is also the name of the monument, in Kashmir, was a turning point in the skirmishes between India and Pakistan in 1999. Soon after the Indian army captured the peak, the press was full of images of the tricolour planted in the scrubby soils of the summit, and the Indian soldiers who lost their lives became the most celebrated of martyrs. The proximity of Pakistan, and Kutch's popular association with illicit border traffic, means the jingoism of Indraprastha's own Tiger Hill is far from hollow. for it imposes Indian nationalistic political idioms on a region that has historically had very close connections with Sindh across the border in Pakistan. Now, some 7 years after the earthquake, two further ideas have been sanctioned by the government of Gujarat for an official memorial. Perhaps these are attempts to rein in the confusion of memory and political discontent that has characterised life in Kutch in recent years. The first idea is a plantation to contain a tree for the life of each of the 13,000 dead. The architectural consultants awarded the contract to design the park are from a faraway urban centre and envisage contemplative spaces and a museum. Fantastically, and equally improbably, they also proposed different species of trees to represent different caste and religious groups. The plantation was originally planned for a large hillock on the outskirts of the town of Bhuj, but due to a lack of water, this plan was abandoned, and as of April 1, 2008, no alternative land had been found. The second project is in many ways more interesting and involves the preservation of the ruins of the village Adoi in the east of Kutch as a walk-around memorial. At first glance, the eerie ruins and silent emptiness of the now almost uninhabited village evoke the tragedy of loss and the destruction of social life wrought by the earthquake. However, not as all as it appears. Adoi was atypical of villages in eastern Kutch, and the haunting ruins are mostly those of the large second homes of wealthy business families resident in Bombay, most of which, importantly, are still standing, and thus appear as dramatic ruins. In neighbouring and poor villages, shoddy buildings simply collapsed, leaving unimpressive piles of rubble, which were not thought suitable as memorials because they were not dramatic enough. The second part of the illusion of Adoi village is that most of the damages to the houses was caused by pillaging of building materials after the disaster, for earthquakes tend not to remove wooden door frames particularly carefully. Finally, many of the houses of Adoi's poor, which formed less impressive ruins, have been cleared away so visitors may walk around the memorial. The residents of these houses have been resettled elsewhere, contributing directly to the feeling of empty desolation. Pillaging aside, on the surface, the unusual silence of the site suggests a commitment amongst local people to the idea that the village should be left to stand as a memorial. Probe just a little deeper, and it is clear the project was first and foremost an opportunity for some influential property owners to receive substantial amounts of compensation from the government. The project has bitterly divided villages, and there have been numerous court cases, and slanderous battles have been waged in the classified section of the local newspaper, which is a way to avoid libel law. And, despite various government orders and the high-handed tactics of some local men of influence, life is indeed gradually returning to the ruins. This, it seems to me, is all utterly typical of a memorial in gestation. In Kutch, there has been no consistent way of memorialising the earthquake, and most formal memorials have been given to the region by outsiders. If you know where to look, there are other memorials scattered throughout the district, but most of these are similarly incongruous as Tiger Hill and Adoi, with no local precedent in terms of either design or sentiment. Each tends to reflect primarily the agenda and intervention of an outside agency in the reconstruction process. Local people, in contrast, have been quite unenthusiastic about public memorials. Discussions in Bhuj about the construction of a memorial by the citizenry have not yet amounted to much. Popular ideas have included the preservation of a ruined neighbourhood and a traditional style house filled with possessions of the dead. Neither of these ideas is particularly novel or indigenous in inception. Inspired by memorials for the Holocaust in Europe and an earthquake memorial in Japan. Significantly, enthusiasm for both projects evaporated once the possibility of international funding receded. Just to complete this overview of the haphazard collection of memorials that has been imposed on Kutch since 2001, it is worth noting that the epicentre has not been marked, perhaps because there was no consensus and now apparently no interest in where it was. Bill Clinton inaugurated a memorial in the town of Anjar soon after the earthquake, but it was later removed because it was illegally built on private property and was determined to be an act of trespass. Finally, one of the most prominent memorials, a dramatic black marble plinth erected in the town of Bhachau, the symbolic gateway between Kutch and Gujarat, has already been bulldozed to make way for a park to commemorate the life of a long-dead leader of the downtrodden. There are, of course, a great many ways in which the earthquake is personally evoked in the lives of ordinary Kutchis, such as shrines in domestic spaces for dead relatives, the preservation of the possessions of the dead, as well as the daily memories evoked by the persistence of the town itself. There are no caste-specific memorials as far as I know. Most memorials constructed by local people and citizens' collectives are nearly always tied to the reconstruction projects, such as those that mark the death and regeneration of life and buildings when particular urban neighbourhoods are rebuilt. These come to the fore at the anniversary of the disaster. Here, memorials, at least for the Hindu population, are more about the process and meaning of cyclical religious rituals than they are about the culture of grave objects and remembering the earthquake. The tsunami and Sri Lanka. On the 26th of December 2004, a series of immense waves rolled onto the Sri Lankan shores following an earthquake off the west coast of northern Sumatra. The tsunami struck a relatively thin but extremely long swathe extending over 1,000 kilometres, approximately two-thirds of the island's coastline. It left 33,000 people dead, 3,800 missing, and 15,000 injured. It reduced around 75,000 houses to rubble and damaged even more, leaving over 900,000 people displaced and entire districts without basic services. As in Gujarat, the tsunami was seen as a sign of divine retribution for the betrayal of cultural traditions and the embrace of an immoral, consumerist, westernised culture. The fact that many places of worship remained unscathed was used to drive this point home, despite engineers arguing that this was due to superior building materials used in their construction. Unlike in the primary lower-income housing along the coast, which was unable to withstand the force of the waves. The areas worst affected by the tsunami, the northern and eastern regions of the island, had for the past 25 years been the site of a civil war between the government of Sri Lanka and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, the LTTE, while most of the southern regions affected were limping back from a youth insurrection which lasted from 1987 to 1990, in which some 40,000 people had disappeared. These embattled regions were now not only reinscribed by the ferocity of the ocean, but subsequent waves of reconstruction and memorialisation, which reiterated socio-political tensions and fissures. Priority was given to the speedy rehabilitation of the Sinhala-dominated southern regions, rather than the Tamil and Muslim-dominated northern and eastern areas. As in Gujarat, government ministers vied with each other to twin the patronage they extended to new housing settlements, with the erection of tsunami memorials along the main coastal road. Many such memorials are now locally known by the names of politicians. The most infamous one, for example, near the site where a train carrying over 1,500 people was swept off the track, is now locally referred to as the Fernando Poole Memorial, after the minister who oversaw its construction. A collective representing those who perished in this train, however, has erected a counter-memorial next to the Fernando Poole Memorial, and where about 300 bodies lie in a mass grave, declaring that these deaths were not merely due to the tsunami, but also to those in authority neglecting their responsibility. This flimsy memorial, however, has to be constantly rebuilt as the collective has been unable to erect a permanent structure due to the owner of the land being engaged in a dispute with the state regarding compensation for unlawfully using the land as a grave site. The badly battered train, of which the Fernando Poole Memorial now stands as a tragic reminder, given the graphic depiction of its derailment in the large mural, which is a central part of it, it had also become an impromptu memorial soon after the tsunami. Thousands, both local and foreign, flocked to it, and it quickly became a money spinner for some locals who began to sell entrance tickets and souvenirs. Others took to begging from the visitors. When it became a site of contention between those who wished it to be made a permanent memorial and others who wished it to be taken away, it led to further fissures developing in the village. The state moved the carriages, promising to turn it into a museum. It now lies rusting and forgotten in a disused railway yard. The villagers who heatedly fought over the train largely ignore the Fernando Poole Memorial. It's rumoured that some smashed the light fittings on the day it was opened. They also ignore the rather ad hoc photo gallery and museum, which has been set up by a Dutch activist across the road from it. Many villagers have now relocated to new settlements inland, and others who remain prefer to memorialise the dead in ways they see appropriate. A group of 10 families is sponsoring an illuminated pinwheel behind a seated Buddha statue encased in glass. In turn, a local monk, with funds from a Taiwanese monastery, built a structure on which he hung mourning flags to commemorate the ruins of his ancestral home, particularly to memorialise his wife and son. He said, "It's a symbol of my grief as well as of my anger that the government has been so neglectful." These now ragged black and white flags soon became symbols of his defiance of an order for their removal made by the local government. This teacher was also scathing about a 50-foot Buddha statue constructed by a politically powerful local monk under the patronage of a government ministry with funding from a Japanese monastery, which was built just a little further down the road. The 55 million rupees spent on it should have been used to materially resuscitate the tsunami affected, rather than seeking to effect their mental rehabilitation. Interestingly, the plaque containing a message from the president proclaims this statue to symbolise the Buddhist temples destroyed by the tsunami and the World Heritage Buddha statues destroyed by terrorists. The latter is a reference to the Bamiyan Buddha statues destroyed by the Taliban in Afghanistan and supposedly replicated by the statue on the coastal road in Sri Lanka. This dynamic interplay between the state and the critical citizenry is absent in the north and east, particularly in areas populated by the Tamil minority. In Bataclava district, for example, the populace not only has to contend with the militarised face of the state, but also with the LTTE and its competing breakaway factions. Resourcefulness in the face of isolation and vulnerability is exemplified in the tsunami memorialisations. Fishermen's cooperatives, sports clubs and village committees have taken the lead. The series of simple, column-like memorials, poignant reminders of decimated coastal communities, extend all the way along the east coast and are a result of collective community efforts. Their verticality is striking and not replicated elsewhere, though one cannot discount possible resonances with an LTTE memorial to 186 villagers who were massacred by government forces in 1990, just to the north of Bataclava. These memorials are now frequently reduced to ghostly sentinels at night due to community coffers no longer being able to afford the astronomical electricity bills. In contrast, the Buddha statue besides the southern coastal road is illuminated at the state's expense. Despite the tsunami affecting people of all religions, ethnicities, classes and religions, there are no plans to erect a national memorial that could articulate a shared language of loss and bereavement. This, of course, is hardly surprising, given the state's pro-Sinhala Buddhist southern policies, not only in terms of post-tsunami reconstruction and memorialisation, but also when it comes to memorialising other extraordinary events of violence. A national shrine to the innocents memorialises deaths and disappearances during the Southern Youth Uprising. But no national memorial commemorates civilians killed during the anti-Tamil riots of 1983 or the current civil war that's now run into decades. A comparative conclusion. How am I to explain such clear differences in the memorialising practices of the two countries? Can I put such differences down to the nature and degree of the impact of the disaster? Because greater percentages of villagers died in Sri Lanka than in Gujarat, is the need to memorialise and remember simply greater? Or should I seek an explanation in the cultural imperatives of two quite different societies? I could argue that there were fewer memorials in Gujarat because of a dominance of Brahminical Hindu ideas about the erasure of individual identity at the point of death. Yet, Hindus in Sri Lanka have been as assiduous as Buddhists in erecting memorials. A wave is an easier thing to graphically depict than an earthquake, But is this the only explanation as to why there are no memorials with graphic imagery in Gujarat? Or should I turn again to a cultural explanation regarding different traditions of representation? Is the state so much stronger in Gujarat, or civil society so much weaker than in Sri Lanka, that only the state can erect memorials in Gujarat? I could perhaps also argue that in India, historically, people have had more recourse to the state than in Sri Lanka, where minority communities have long stopped expecting the state to be a caretaker. Then I come to the thorny question of memorials and religious identity. With the exception of the first anniversary of the earthquake in Gujarat, which was marked by the state with explicitly Hindu rituals to appease angry earth deities, when compared to Sri Lanka, the memorialising practices of both the government of Gujarat and other state governments that funded reconstruction work are, in many respects, remarkably secular, for want of a better word. Given the reputation of the government in Gujarat for Hindu nationalism, this is somewhat surprising. I could argue that this was a reflection of the ideals and traditions of Indian democratic secularism in action. Alternatively, I could also, and perhaps equally convincingly, argue that the secular tinge to memorials in Gujarat is an echo of the memorial practices and aesthetics of the colonial state. The British were, after all, the chief memorialisers in India, at least during recent centuries. But they were similarly industrious in Sri Lanka. So, maybe a more productive angle would be to assume that statecraft in Sri Lanka, given the recent turbulent history of the country, is popularly legitimised amongst its supporters by the symbols of Buddhism, and therefore memorials simply reflect this. Similarly, I might argue that the absence of Muslim monuments to the dead in both countries is a result of religiously sanctioned restrictions on visual and iconic representation. However, all this notwithstanding, at the beginning of this lecture, I argued that memorials were not simply about memory or culture. I hope it's clear in the way I've provided a series of tentative and conflicting answers to my own initial comparative questions that I do not utterly discount either memory or culture as a mode of explanation for the existence or non-existence of memorials. Yet it seems that two or more conflicting and contradictory reasons can readily be given to explain the existence of a phenomenon, in this case, memorials. This suggests that a straightforward reliance on ideas about either memory or culture is inadequate in and of itself to explain the presence or absence of memorials. I hope it is clear that serendipity and compromise also play significant and determining roles in all aspects of the memorial business, and that these processes often override the concerns of memory and culture. Aside from the elementary fact that both disasters prompted the creation of memorials, there is another strong similarity between the two locations. In both instances, memorials have been used to consolidate and publicise political protest against the state, while the state has used memorials in an attempt to impose its authority. Memorials have thus become a medium of communication. They have become nodal points in contestation through language of loss and bereavement. Rather than bringing people together, as some writers on the subject have suggested, memorials have frequently exacerbated old conflicts and encouraged new social cleavages. In southern Sri Lanka, many tsunami memorials have been constructed by the state without the consultation or participation of the bereaved. In such a context, that is, where the state seeks to be the sole arbiter of meaning, memorials have become exercises in what we might call biopolitics. Memorials have become sites of symbolic exchange. Death is both deconstructed, horror, trauma, and individuality is buried, and reinvested with meaning as an abstraction, a collective sacrifice. Tiger Hill in Gujarat is particularly instructive in this regard, as it seamlessly folds memorialization of the earthquake into the memorialization of the battle for Kashmir. In a similar but different register, the Sri Lankan state has built a Buddha statue, which not only seeks to recuperate tsunami-destroyed Buddhist temples within the country, but makes claims on a wider Buddhist universe, while simultaneously providing an indictment of terrorism by invoking the Bamyan statues of Afghanistan. Other memorials discussed here, however, seem more to be forms of cultural compromise that have emerged haphazardly out of conflict and dispute, as well as from agreement. As such, memorials can only be thought of as beacons of cultural meaning, because their construction reflects processes of negotiation and perhaps prevalent ideas of visual and ritual aesthetics. It is also worth recalling that the location of memorials also often simply reflects the regulative capacities of national planning regimes. The material I have presented demonstrates that memorials, as manifestations of compromise, often without local precedent, are creative and extraordinary acts that may routinise and synthesise similarly extraordinary events and atypical emotions and will.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now the next lecture from the Free University of the Airwaves on Resonance 104.4 FM, given by Malcolm.